Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloh. Our guest for this program is Emily Levesque. As a lifelong amateur astronomer myself, space science journalist, and history buff, the world of professional astronomy has always fascinated me. So when I recently received the book, The Last Stargazers by Levesque, a professional astronomer, I was intrigued and looked forward to reading it over the holidays. I was not disappointed. In fact, of all the books I've ever read on the subject by authors like Timothy Ferris, I can truthfully say that The Last Stargazers sits at or near the top of my all-time favorites for this genre. Astronomy is in many ways the gateway to science interest for kids of all ages, but as it is actually practiced on remote mountaintops across the globe, it is poorly understood. And that's the beauty of The Last Stargazers, which demystifies the lives of professional astronomers while being highly entertaining to read. Emily Levesque joined us recently from her home near the University of Washington, where she's a professor of astronomy. Emily Levesque, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks for having me.
So your book, The Last Stargazers, is it's definitely, I would put it in my top five books that I've read in the last 5 years, you know, right up there with Sasha Sagan's wonderful book, For Small Creatures Such as We. It's just a really neat read. And for somebody like me that has a lifelong love of astronomy and the history of astronomy, it was the perfect thing to read during the pandemic. And I just thoroughly enjoyed it. So I want to just get that right off my chest at the beginning.
Well, thank you so much.
I loved it. Well, let's first of all talk about the title. Why The Last Stargazers?
Yeah, so this is something that a lot of people have asked me about because the title can sound really sad and really depressing. And I like to think that it's not at all a depressing book. It's a book, in a lot of cases, about the sort of joy and adventure of what it's like to be a scientist and specifically what it's like to be an astronomer. So the title is in part a reference to the way that technology is changing astronomy and the role that astronomers play in our own jobs. We used to be at the telescope whenever we observed. In some cases, we were literally attached to a telescope all night. And things have really changed dramatically since then. We still observe at telescopes, but we might be in a nearby warm room rather than in the dome with the telescope itself, or we may be at a distant remote operating facility. I write in the book about telescopes that I can run with my laptop from my couch. And robotic telescopes are starting to remove some astronomers from the observing process entirely. So I wanted to write a book that kind of saved the stories of observing from a time when it was more deeply hands-on, and a book that kind of looks at the human role that can be played in astronomy and stargazing and how that's shifting. And it's also, the title is also meant to be a bit of a challenge because lots of people still stargaze either for their jobs or just for pleasure. And I think it's really important to continue recognizing and using that passion and the love that people have for stargazing. So if anybody sees the title, The Last Stargazers, and goes, well, hey, no, I stargaze. My kid likes space. What do you mean, The Last? I kind of hope that it sparks a little bit of, you know, what does this mean and what would The Last Stargazers maybe mean now or going forward?
Yeah, and it's, you know, it is becoming increasingly difficult to stargaze, to just go out and look at the night sky for so many people because of, you know, light pollution. And now even, you know, with the number of satellites crowding the sky, that is also causing a problem for professional astronomy.
Yeah, absolutely. The book kind of got finished. I got finished writing the book just about as problems with satellite constellations started becoming more apparent. So things like Starlink. And I have colleagues that are very much embedded in trying to understand how we can possibly coexist with so many satellites in the night sky, if there are alternate solutions to sort of clogging the night sky with light pollution sources, and people who also work with light pollution on the ground. But I think preserving the night sky as a natural resource and as a scientific resource is really key. And without that, then we really may be looking at some of the last days of stargazing as we know it.
Yeah. Well, I always like to start out with somebody like you, with your origin story and how you got interested in astronomy. A lot of times with the scientists that I talk to, whatever the field is, it was a trip to a museum or an aquarium, or perhaps an observatory or a planetarium. With you, it seems to be, from what I've read, it was really kind of in the backyard with your parents. Would that be kind of a good way to approach how you got interested in astronomy?
Yes. I think people are surprised sometimes when I tell them, well, I've been interested in astronomy literally since I was two, but apparently that's the truth, that my big brother in 1986 had a school project to study Halley's Comet because it was making its last sort of close flyby to Earth. And our whole family went out into the backyard for him to work on this project. And I was really little and kind of tired and kind of, you know, fussy and cranky, and it was dark and it was cold, until my parents pointed me up. And apparently I was just mesmerized by the night sky. They managed to get me to look through our little backyard telescope. And from then on, I was the little kid where someone would ask what I wanted to be when I grew up. And it would be, oh, I want to be a ballerina or an astronomer, or a firefighter or an astronomer, or a violinist or an astronomer. An astronomer just always stuck. And when I got to college, or as I was getting ready to go to college, I had this choice of whether I wanted to pursue something like music, which I also loved a lot, or to get into astronomy. And I realized that I would really miss being a part of astronomy and miss the chance to be part of that scientific community. So it really, the seed got planted really, really young.
There was one, and I don't remember exactly who it was. You can tell us. You got some advice that I thought was very profound. It's so simple, and yet it's the exact right thing to hear for a kid who's interested in astronomy. And that was somebody, I think a teacher or a professor of astronomy, somebody that was into astronomy, telling you, you know, you needed to take as many math classes as possible, that math was the gateway. And that imprinted and you accepted that. Can you talk about how important that really is?
Math is the language of science, very much so. And I liked math well enough as a kid. I don't think I would have called it my favorite subject, but I liked that I was not too bad at it, and I liked sort of puzzle aspect of it. But getting this advice from the only astronomer I ever met as a child, because I didn't grow up knowing people who were professional scientists or PhDs or anything like that. And this was an astronomer I talked to on an open sort of telescope night at a nearby college. And the advice was, you know, take all the math you can. I just sort of saw it as, okay, I have a goal and this is how I'm going to reach that goal. And I wound up coming to really love math later just for the elegance of it. But it's crucial. I mean, math absolutely drives the way that we describe how stars work, how the universe has evolved. It really shows up in every single aspect of my job. So I think math is one of two key building blocks that we have as scientists. The other one being computer science, which I came to a little later, but which has also been really, really valuable in my job.
Oh, yeah, because, you know, a huge part of astronomy is not so much the observations, which are the critical data gathering, but it's what you do with the data once you've gathered it.
Exactly. It's interpreting the data. There's a misconception sometimes that astronomers spend all of our time at telescopes. When I tell somebody, like on an airplane, that I'm an astronomer, I'll get asked sometimes, you know, how are you awake right now? Or shouldn't you just be at a telescope all the time? And we'll spend a handful of really precious and hard to get and crucial nights at a telescope. And then we'll spend months working on the data and using our laptops, or in some cases really immense supercomputers, or the mathematical and physical theory that we've learned to figure out what the data are trying to tell us. So that's where we spend a lot of our time.
One of my favorite parts of your book is early on, when you kind of take us through, in a way, the history of astronomy and how that's evolved over time. From the, you know, the first astronomers didn't have even a way to use photography. They're just basically visual astronomers and making sketches. And some of those sketches are just incredible, you know, and really interesting to look at. And then the era of the glass plates. And you know, that was such a phenomenal time, especially, you know, the time of the 1920s when you have the big telescopes being built, like the 100-inch Hooker telescope on Mount Wilson, and Hubble making his, you know, phenomenal observations. Could you talk a bit about, you know, that early period and some of the cool stories you tell about what it was like to be an astronomer during that time?
So I knew at the very start of writing this book that I wanted to at least delve a little bit into the history of astronomy because it helps you understand how we got to where we are today. And today all of our images are digital, but I had colleagues who had described days of working when you would capture this image of, say, a galaxy that you labored over for hours, and your only copy of it was on this fragile glass plate. So I really wanted to hear from people about what that was like. And I think you could, in truth, fill an entire book with just the tales of what it was like to do that kind of research. It was arduous. People would stay at the telescope all night, sort of perched high above the ground, above the telescope's mirror, sitting at the telescope's camera, shuffling glass plates and trying to work with them in the cold. It was a very physical type of job. And these plates were treated chemically so that they would darken when they were exposed to light. So somebody would use a plate inside a camera to take a sort of color negative picture of the night sky. But the plates had to be sliced down to size. They had all these little chemical tricks that they would use to make them respond to light as fast as possible. You had to develop them after the fact in a dark room. So at the end of a long night of observing, I get to hit, save on my computer and go to bed. And these observers would go into a dark room and develop the plates almost right away. So hearing all of their stories about the immense labor that went into the data was great. And one of the things I got to do during my research for this book was go to the Carnegie Plate Library in California and get to see some examples of plates. Now I'd seen one like once in a while previously, but you kind of think of it as, oh, well, that's maybe old-timey photographs and primitive technology, and how much science would you really get out of them? And they're exquisite pieces of data. And you mentioned things like Edwin Hubble making groundbreaking discoveries about literally the size of our universe using glass plates. So it was really amazing to see them and think about how much time and effort and work had gone into these plates, how delicate they are, but how much really amazing science is contained on them. So hearing those stories from my colleagues was one of my favorite parts of all of the research that I did for the book.
Yeah, and there was one person that stuck out in my mind. Wallerstein? George Wallerstein, who he spanned the entire period of, this up to the digital revolution. Could you talk about, tell us a bit about him?
Yeah. So I'm so glad that you asked about George. I'm very lucky to count him as a colleague at the University of Washington. And I interviewed him shortly after he'd celebrated his 60th anniversary of observing. So he observed for 30 years with glass photographic plates and then 30 years with digital imaging. And he on his own is just a larger-than-life character. And you can read more about him in the book, but he's a pilot, a boxer, a mountaineer. He's won awards for his humanitarian work, and he's an absolutely brilliant scientist. His specialty is figuring out the inner workings of stars and using the chemistry of stars to kind of figure out their history, where they came from, how they might die. But he's, taking really precise chemical measurements of extraordinarily distant stars. And his stories of learning how to handle glass plates and then shifting over to digital imaging were just wonderful to hear. And he, to me, was an example of a anti-stereotype that I think people can sometimes associate with scientists or even with older scientists. You would imagine somebody like George might, want to stick with glass plates and stick with the way things were and say, well, this method worked well for decades. Why should we change it and go with these newfangled technology techniques? And he and many of his colleagues completely embraced every new advance that we had in astronomy as we went to digital imaging and as we went to more automated imaging, because he could see the amazing scientific gains that you would get from making those changes. So he was all in on learning these new ways of observing and getting more science out of it as a result. So yeah, George is one of the more fascinating observers that I got to talk to as part of researching this book. And I talked to quite a lot of really interesting people.
Yeah, no, and he's just one of so many stories. And like I said, if you want to hear all the stories, you got to read the book, but we'll touch on some of them here. If you're just joining us, our guest is Emily Levesque. She's a professional astronomer and the author of the new book, The Last Stargazers. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. This is Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. Let's continue now with my conversation with Emily Levesque. Her new book, The Last Stargazers, is an inside look at the world of professional astronomy. You know, I also want you to give people a sense of, if you were an astronomer during that age, you know, say back in the 20s when some of the really pioneering work on was going on discovering the expansion of the universe on top of Mount Wilson. Those were very difficult conditions to be working in all night. Can you just describe what it would be like to be in an observatory dome like that on a cold winter night, and how long, you know, that is, and how demanding and at times dangerous it could be?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was a really fascinating era to think about. And I'll start, I suppose, by describing what it would be like for, say, you to be an observer in the 1920s, because I, as a woman and astronomer in the 1920s, would have been hit with a lot of really interesting restrictions on whether I was allowed to be an observer at a telescope and whether I was permitted to even stay in the, you know, lodging on the mountain where astronomers were hosted. There were women who absolutely made it happen anyway, but a more typical experience might be you heading up to the mountain with a bunch of glass plates and preparing to observe and having a carefully planned list of every single thing that you wanted to point the telescope at. With that list, you would then start to prepare your glass plates. So you would pull these plates out of a big, heavy box. You'd use a diamond sort of roller cutter to slice them down to size. And you'd be doing all this work in the dark, because as soon as you expose that plate to light, it starts to darken and it ruins the potential image that you could take. So you're slicing a sharp glass plate with a sharp cutter, hoping you don't, you know, hit yourself. And I heard a couple stories of mishaps that happened when people were trying to do this step. You might bake the plate or freeze the plate. You might rub lemon juice on it or distilled water or whatever chemical trick you might have learned to make the plate as sensitive to light as possible. And then finally, with the series of prepared plates, you would climb up to the top of the telescope. So dozens of feet above usually the cold concrete floor of a telescope dome, and climb into what we called the prime focus cage. So this was this tiny little literal cage that you would sit in right next to the telescope's camera, clutching all your plates, trying not to drop anything, and you'd be hunkering down there for the night. You might be up there for 7, 8, 9 straight hours. Your night assistant would turn the telescope to wherever you might want to point. So you're sort of drifting through the air high above the dome floor along with the telescope. And when you got to roughly where you wanted to be, you would pull out one of these glass plates. You might even need to try and bend it a little bit to fit it into the camera, hoping it doesn't, you know, snap in your hands sitting in the dark. And then once you load the plate in, you'll open the shutter of the camera, make sure that you're pointed exactly where you want to be, and then you wait for hours sometimes to make sure that you're getting enough light from the distant star or galaxy that you're observing on that plate to actually produce an image that you can study later. And you hope that the camera's working well, that the plate has been prepared properly. You hope that a cloud doesn't happen to drift across the part of the sky that you're studying. And then hours later, once that's happened, you close the shutter, take that exposed plate out, load in the next one, go to the next spot and start again. And you'll do this all night, usually shivering in the cold. If you were lucky, maybe you'd be wearing something like an old World War II pilot surplus flight suit that you could plug in to give yourself a little bit of warmth. But the dome itself had to be very cold. It had to be the same temperature as the air outside, because if it was warm in there, you'd get those ripples of warm air that you might see rising off the pavement on a hot day. And it would mess with the quality of the picture that you were taking. So that would be your night. That would be all the effort that you went into to even capture a little bit of data that you wanted. You'd then go back down to the ground. You'd develop the plates. You would hope this whole time that the plates don't break. A few people would break a plate and then, you know, doggedly go on to try and develop the shards to see if they could find data in there. And then the scientific research would start once you'd gone to all of this effort to get that data and get that image and have it in a place where you could then peer at it and study it and try to pull out the physics of the star that you were studying or the shape of the galaxy that you'd imaged and to try and piece together little bits of the universe from these pieces of glass.
Wow. And I think it might be good to point out for many of our listeners how these telescopes work, because they have a gigantic mirror at the back of the telescope that's collecting this light. You're not looking through, you know, like a pirate's spyglass that's just a big giant version of that, of a refracting telescope with lenses. These are reflecting telescopes. And like you said, you're riding in the prime focus. So that's like at the top of the telescope. And so I want our listeners to get a picture. Could you maybe describe what these telescopes look like for them?
Yeah. Any of your listeners that might have looked through a backyard telescope, they may have a rough idea of what these telescopes look like, because most of the telescopes that we keep in our backyards, or that you might get to peek into during something like Astronomy Open House, are reflecting telescopes. So they use a series of mirrors to collect the light from the stars and then bounce that light into an eyepiece or a camera, or in the telescopes that we've been describing, the cameras that hold glass plates. So if you take the kind of telescope that you might look through in your backyard, you may be used to looking through an eyepiece at the back end of the telescope. If you take that telescope and then inflate it so that the mirror goes from being, say, 6 or 8 inches wide to 100 inches across, 200 inches across, so 10, 11, 12 feet across, the observer in this case would be perched at the far end of the telescope, so at the opposite end from where you're used to having an eyepiece, because up there, the telescope would have a camera specifically situated to collect all the light, bouncing and reflecting off of the telescope's big main mirror. So when you look at an enormous telescope, it sometimes doesn't look at all to your eye like the telescope that you're used to seeing in a backyard, but it's very much the same principle. It's just made enormous.
Yeah. That reminded me of a quick anecdote I'd like you to share. Is you described what it would look like and what it looks like to see the night sky in one of these giant mirrors. Could you describe that? Because that was just stunning to me. The visual I got in my head of like, oh wow, what would it be look like to look at like at the 200-inch mirror full of stars?
Yeah, so this actually is a very interesting optical, I don't want to say optical illusion because it's very real, but it's a very interesting optical trick that happens with these enormous mirrors, because something like the 200-inch telescope at Palomar that you just mentioned, this 200-inch across mirror is curved so that it will very perfectly focus all of the light to a single point. And as a result of that, there's a point you can sit at above the mirror where all the light that mirror has collected has focused. And normally we put a camera there so that we can capture the image that's being focused. But I talked to a couple astronomers who happened to be at that sort of focus point of the telescope, just themselves with their eyes. And to hear them describe it, seeing the collected light of the stars reflected and focused directly in front of your face, it's almost surreal, because it looks like you have this strange field of or swarm of floating lights sitting directly in front of you, like moving very slowly, but it looks like a sort of strange still swarm of fireflies drifting across your vision. And what you're seeing is the stars focused by the telescope sitting directly in front of you. As it's been described before, it looks like you can reach out with your hand and just scoop up some stars, or reach out and stick your hands directly into the universe and handle the stars. And it's a trick of how the light works, but it's a really surreal and amazing perspective to get on the night sky, sitting at sort of the business end of one of these amazingly powerful telescopes.
Wow. And I would imagine a very rare occurrence for somebody to get to experience that.
It was very rare at any time, because oftentimes, like I said, you'd have a camera or something at that point, but a few people did have that experience to share with me. Nowadays, it's almost impossible, because when we do put instruments at the prime focus of a telescope, it's typically a big, very advanced digital camera, or we might put another mirror there to reflect light down to a camera somewhere else. When I was researching the book, I tried to get the chance to sit up at the prime focus of a telescope, and I couldn't find an observatory that still did it, that was still equipped to put people up there, because the way we observe has changed so much.
And when you decided to write this book, you must have, you know, thought to yourself, I want to bring people into this world that I live in. What was the genesis for you deciding, I'm going to write a book about this?
Yeah. So the story of how the book came to be actually started with someone asking me, have you ever thought about writing a book? I've written a couple of textbooks in astronomy. So I had someone ask me whether I'd considered the idea of a popular science book. And my immediate answer was, oh no, not really. I've always loved writing. I've always loved the idea of writing a book. I just don't really have an idea, but let's get together and meet. I want to learn more about the publishing process, which was very new to me. And while we were meeting, the idea for this book just started appearing in my head and coming out of my mouth at the same time. It's the only time I've ever had that experience. But what I was thinking of as we met was the use of storytelling to teach science, and then thinking about the stories that astronomers tell each other. And when we are hanging out at a conference or killing time during a cloudy night at a telescope, we tell each other these stories and sort of half legends and semi-tall tales of what working at a telescope is like. And I remember getting that welcome on my first visit to an observatory with people saying things like, oh, did you ever hear about that telescope in Texas that got shot? Or did you hear about the person who was observing and they had a raccoon crawl into their lap while they were sitting in the telescope dome in the dark? Or did you ever hear the story about the guy who was observing when Mount St. Helens erupted 90 miles away? And they're partly just, you know, stories that kind of welcome other astronomers into the field, and they introduce everyone to the sort of human tales and the human side of astronomy. But you also have to understand astronomy to get why the stories make sense. You know, why would you have a telescope out in the middle of nowhere, 90 miles from Mount St. Helens? Why is it such a big deal that a telescope mirror might get shot? What exactly does that do to a telescope mirror? So it seemed like a great way to bring people, like you said, into this world and give them a behind-the-scenes view of astronomy, where they simultaneously got to know the astronomers and also got to learn the science that helped them understand why these stories are so interesting.
How long did you take in collecting interviews and material for this book? How long was this project from your initial idea to the fruition of the book being finished?
I remember getting the idea in January of 2017, because it happened at a big annual astronomy conference that a lot of us go to. And in August of that year, I did my first interview, which was George Wallerstein. He was my very first interview with my newly purchased little voice recorder. I did about a year and a half of interviews and then wrote the book kind of alongside the interviews. And so, yeah, I think from end to end, it was about 2.5 years from idea to holding the manuscript that I ultimately sent off.
Wow. And one of my favorite parts of your book is just those anecdotes, the stories of, you know, sometimes the downtime that you have when, you know, it's really windy and you really can't do anything. So you go walk outside and here you are on this remote mountaintop and you get to experience, you know, being under the sky at elevation. Could you talk about where these telescopes are? Because a lot of them are at very high elevation and very remote places. So I was wondering if maybe could you take us on a tour around the world of the telescopes that you have visited?
Yes. Since a lot of my work is done using some of the biggest telescopes that we have available to us, I've been very lucky to visit some beautiful observatories across the world. Some of the best places to do astronomy on the planet are in Chile, so in the sort of foothills of the Andes, and in Hawaii and Arizona. So states that are close to the equator that can give you access to very dark, very high, very dry places. And in the book, I talk a lot about the observatories of Chile. That was actually I think that would have been the very first international trip I ever took, was going to Cerro Tololo Observatory in Chile and getting to see a new country for the first time, getting to see the incredible desert that is the sort of foothills to the Andes, seeing the animals that are there. I got to see wild guanacos, so sort of the wild version of alpacas, and Chilean condors and all of these just creatures that I never knew we shared the planet with. It was such a wonderful way to learn what our planet was like while studying, you know, very distant places in the universe. but all of these observatories sites have in common beautiful, crisp, clear air so that you can take excellent pictures of the night sky. Fairly remote locations so that they're very dark so that you have as little light pollution as possible. And mountain environments where you're hopefully going to have a combination of very good weather and then a very remote, out of the way place that sort of has to be built to be accessible for the scientists that go use it. So in the book, you probably hear the most about Chile and Hawaii and Arizona, the places that I've been. And those are really some of the best sites on the planet for astronomy.
Yeah. What's the highest elevation of the big observatories you've worked at?
Oh, it's funny. There is one of the highest observatories, period, certainly the highest world-class observatory, is on the summit of Mauna Kea in Hawaii, which truly is one of the most exquisite places possible to do observational astronomy. I know that there is a very small observatory in Colorado that's a little bit higher, that's unfortunately been beset with some, you know, telescope damage and funding problems because the weather's a little harsher there. But the highest altitudes for the kinds of telescopes that I use are around 14,000 feet. And then there are a couple of telescopes specifically designed to detect wavelengths of light that are much redder than basically what our eyes can see. And those will go even higher. Those are up at 16,000, 17,000 feet in the high plains of the Andes in Chile.
Wow. And there's not as much oxygen up there as there is at sea level. So you have to, I imagine, really adapt to that.
Yes. When you observe in Hawaii, they actually make you stay overnight at a lodging about halfway up the mountain so that you can acclimatize to the altitude. And the very high altitude observatory in Chile, I know that they don't have people sleep up at the telescope itself because it's simply too high. And when people are working up there, they'll actually use supplemental oxygen because working with telescopes can be very dangerous. This is heavy, delicate equipment. And we know that one consequence of being oxygen deprived is your judgment gets impaired and your just like physical and mental acuity both go down. So for safety reasons, they give everybody supplemental oxygen when they're working that high.
You mentioned Chile, and there was one scene that I definitely want you to share with us. And I forget what the name of the creatures are. There's some kind of like rabbit-like creatures up there where they go out and they like to watch the sunset.
Yes. So these are vizcachas. They're these little relatives of chinchillas. And if you try to find a picture of these guys, they look like wise little bunny grandfathers because they've got big long ears and these droopy little whiskers. And they're native to the area in Chile around where a lot of our observatories are. And I think if astronomers had to pick sort of a favorite animal or like a mascot animal of astronomy, it might be vizcachas. Because we see them at these observatories and we specifically see them watching sunsets. I actually tried when I was writing this book to look up research on anything that had been done on vizcachas to explain why they might do this. And I didn't see anything, but every astronomer will tell you that they'll typically turn up as the sun is going down and they'll just sort of be perched on the mountainside staring out at the setting sun. And they're doing exactly what these other animals on the mountain, the astronomers, are doing because we all love to admire the sunset and watch the sun going down. Our excuse is probably that it gives us a sense of what the sky conditions are going to be like. But in truth, it's just beautiful. And being in these beautiful out-of-the-way places and getting to watch the planet turn and watching night arrive is just a wonderful part of observing. And sharing it with these little animals that are on the same mountain as us and on the same planet as us is a really sort of unique and memorable aspect of doing our observing. Seeing these creatures is always one of the highlights of any trip to Chile, certainly for me, and I think for a lot of my colleagues, because they've really become our companions in sky observing.
Yeah, that was so cool. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with professional astronomer and author of the new book, The Last Stargazers, Emily Levesque. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. We'll be right back. glad we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to our conversation with professional astronomer and author Emily Levesque. Let's talk about different kinds of telescopes from optical telescopes. You got to spend some time at the VLA, the Very Large Array, in Socorro, New Mexico. Tell us about some of your adventures with radio astronomy. I got a big kick out of the fact that when you got there and, you know, started listening to the lingo going on, it was like, uh-oh, this is a language with which I'm not quite familiar.
Oh, yes. So this is an aspect of astronomy that I've always found fascinating and something that I think gets missed sometimes when you see a scientist really in any field depicted in a movie. I think there's an assumption that once you're an astronomer, you know all astronomy and you can easily do whatever type of astronomy might be available to you. And radio astronomy deals with a type of light that is much redder and has a much longer wavelength than our eyes can see. And the physics of collecting and studying that light can actually be very different than the physics of collecting the light we see with our eyes. So I had studied sort of more classical astronomy, the telescopes with eyepieces that we might look through or standard issue cameras. And when I first visited the Very Large Array, which is this very famous radio observatory in New Mexico, anybody who's seen Contact is familiar with the VLA. I started talking to them about the science of what they were doing. And I absolutely thought I'd stepped into another world. It seemed like they were speaking a different language to me. The way they describe how the telescopes work, how bright something is, how long they point at it, everything is different. And I had this moment of dread of just like, oh no, this is a completely different world than the one I've learned so far. How can it even still be astronomy? It very much is, but it's a very different type of physics and a very different type of science. Radio telescopes are capable of observing in all sorts of conditions that would absolutely destroy a more standard issue telescope. They can observe through clouds, through rainstorms, through snowstorms, through high winds, because the type of light that they're gathering isn't perturbed by something like coming through clouds or traveling through rain. On the flip side, they'll get interference from everything from a Wi-Fi network to a microwave to the sparks of a combustion engine. So that they will detect flashes of radio light from all of those phenomena and see that as sort of false data. So learning the physics of how radio astronomers deal with all of these strange new phenomena that could potentially mess with their data and how they design these enormous telescopes that they use was just a fascinating part of my time as an astronomer and a fascinating part of writing the book, because I really got to delve back into exactly how radio astronomy works and why it's so different.
Yeah, I thought that was particularly fascinating. Oh, I wanted to mention to you, I know it was after your book came out, but tell us your take on the loss of Arecibo.
So yes, Arecibo Observatory is featured in my book, even though the book was written before the telescope, unfortunately, was destroyed. It is got to be one of the more sort of looms large, literally, telescopes in the whole field. I lost track of how many wonderful stories people told me about Arecibo. So this is this 1,000-foot across dish built in Puerto Rico. It's been in movies. It's been in Contact. It's been in GoldenEye. It discovered the first planet around another star. It's made all sorts of just unbelievable discoveries about how the universe works. And it's been operating for decades. And earlier this year, earlier this month, at the very beginning of December, it unfortunately suffered a catastrophic failure. It had been dealing with structural problems and damage for months beforehand, and the National Science Foundation had announced in November that they would be decommissioning the telescope. And the telescope works through this beautiful design where you have a dish sort of built into the ground and then a instrument platform suspended hundreds of feet above the dish, and that instrument platform unfortunately collapsed. One of the key support cables failed and it completely destroyed the telescope. And I think what struck me the most about it was talking to my colleagues about it in the aftermath, and the loss of this telescope was mourned the way people would mourn the loss of a colleague, because it was such a iconic and such a important place to so many people. And the observatory, you know, sort of held the, you know, dreams and souls of so many astronomers who had done groundbreaking research there, who had lived there, who had helped turn it into the amazing research site that it was. So it was really heartbreaking to see it lost. There's a lot of talk about what we could potentially do to maybe either rebuild Arecibo or build a new and amazing radio telescope in its place. But it was a sad loss for the astronomy community, for sure.
So another interesting kind of astronomical experience you described that most people would not think of as a way to explore the heavens is with an airplane and a certain observatory that's built into a large aircraft called Sophia. Could you tell us a little bit about your adventures with that?
Yes, this was one of my favorite adventures that came about as part of writing this book. So SOFIA stands for the Stratospheric Observatory for Infrared Astronomy, and it's exactly what it sounds like. It's a telescope built into the back of a modified Boeing 747 that could fly into the stratosphere and then open its rear door so that the telescope can observe out the back of the plane. I knew when I started writing this book that I wanted to visit SOFIA and that I wanted to learn what it was like to do observational astronomy from an experimental aircraft flying through the stratosphere. And I had a couple kind of unusual adventures trying to get to the point where I got to visit and hoped to fly on SOFIA that are shared in the book. But it fascinated me because, like you said, I think most people don't even realize that this is a way for us to do astronomy. We send telescopes aloft on airplanes, on balloons, on little suborbital rockets that just sort of peek into space for a quick look at whatever it's studying. And that was an element of astronomy that I really wanted to share with people as part of The Last Stargazers.
Yeah, that was. I especially enjoyed your account of being up in the cockpit, because that's not something most people get to do. To be up there and, you know, see the view from up front. When we all get on airplanes, we're usually, you know, most of us are in coach or whatever. But you got it, a really cool experience with those pilots. And I was really impressed by, you know, their role as, you know, teams on SOFIA as the team members.
Yeah, I was very lucky to get the cockpit seat on a SOFIA flight that I was on. I think they knew I was the new person on the plane, so they let me sit there. And I was just fascinated watching us taxi down the runway, because talk about a view you normally don't get as a passenger. Talking to the pilots, though, it was great to hear about sort of how they'd prepared and trained for SOFIA and the precision of the flying that they have to do, because they pilot and point the plane to within seconds of timing precision, because they have to be at a very specific place and time to point the telescope at whatever object we're trying to observe. So talking to them about the training that they went through and what it was like to pilot a plane, and of course I wanted to know what it was like for them to fly a plane with the door that opened, was just fascinating. And it was wonderful of them to give me their time and tell me all about this sort of unexpected job of astronomy, of being a large aircraft pilot.
Yeah, that was way cool for me. Okay, another observatory you visit in the book that most people would not think of as an astrophysical observatory is LIGO. Could you tell us just briefly about your trip to there?
Yes. So LIGO is an observatory that detects something called gravitational waves. So these are ripples in the fabric of space-time that are produced by very violent gravitational events. So things like two black holes colliding. And one of these gravitational wave observatories is right here in Eastern Washington. I'm a professor in Seattle and got to drive out to the other end of the state to see what this observatory was like. I still think it's some of the most exquisite engineering ever achieved in the name of science, because these observatories don't look anything like a traditional telescope. They're two very long, hyper straight arms. Each arm is a little over 2 miles long, and they're so straight that they take the curvature of the Earth into account. And to detect gravitational waves, these observatories bounce lasers up and down these arms, looking for minuscule, tiny, petite changes in the length of the arm that tell you that a ripple of gravitational wave has passed by and perturbed the arm. So I got the chance to tour the facility, to talk to the people who help make it run. These facilities depend on huge teams of people. And I got to hear the story of what it was like to detect gravitational waves for the first time, the excitement of it all the correct skepticism of making sure that what they detected was real, and all sort of while walking around this really unusual but fascinating facility that gives us a look at really how gravity works. That was one of my favorite tours that I got to do as part of researching the book.
Yeah, I found that the engineering behind that is just absolutely mind-boggling, because you're trying to, you know, do something down to the size of, you know, like smaller than a proton. Like to detect something, a wave that's like that small is just astounding to me.
Yeah. And you're trying to make sure that what you've detected truly is this ripple in space-time and not a truck driving by on a highway dozens of miles away. It was a fascinating place.
Yeah. Or a bird pecking on the side of a building nearby
like that. Which they had happen. Yes.
Yeah. It's amazing. Okay. Well, getting about out of time, but before we go, you got to visit one of the great observatories of the future. Could you tell us about the Vera Rubin?
Yes. So I got to visit the Rubin Observatory down in Chile, which is a observatory that's under construction and that should be beginning to observe in the next year or two. And this observatory has a science mission that sounds almost deceptively simple. It's going to image a huge portion of the southern sky once every few days over and over for a decade. And it'll be doing that specifically to look for anything in the sky that changes. Because if you take a picture of the same spot over and over, it means that by comparing those pictures, you can detect a star that suddenly gets brighter or dimmer, or a little asteroid that goes scooting through the frame. And the engineering involved in building a telescope that can do this continuously for 10 years, building the computers that can store the data from all of those observations, is an immense undertaking. But seeing it under construction and getting to learn about sort of how this observatory of the future is being built was really fascinating, because the observatory will take this data. Those of us studying the data will get it probably on our laptops at our desks, and then identify strange or unusual objects that we want to go explore in more detail. So the mission of the observatory is fantastic. And I was also delighted to learn that the observatory is going to be named the Rubin Observatory, named for Vera Rubin. So she's the astronomer who discovered dark matter. She's one of the pioneering women of observational astronomy that I got to write about in the book. And seeing the observatory named for her, knowing what groundbreaking work she did and knowing what groundbreaking work is likely coming from this telescope, it was a wonderful choice for a name.
Yeah, well, there's just so many more stories in the last Stargazers that I highly recommend you, gentle listener, go out and get it at your local bookstore or wherever you get your, you know, book groove on, as we like to say. It's a great book, and thanks for sharing some of the stories with us today, Emily. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks again to our guest, University of Washington astronomer Emily Levesque. Her 2020 book, The Last Stargazers, is available from most booksellers, and I highly recommend it for anyone who has ever wondered what it would be like to be a professional astronomer. Hey, let's do another teachable moment when from time to time on Blue Dot, we have our producer, Matt Fidler, ask a question that he's wondering and pondering about, and then see if I can answer it and hopefully make it more understandable for him and all of you.
This one has to do with, looking out, you know, when it's a full moon and when it's first rising, it seems a lot bigger than when it's a lot higher in the sky later in the night. And why is that?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. This is the famous moon illusion. Because if you were to actually, you know, like, for example, take your thumb and hold it out at arm's length and cover up the moon at moonrise when it looks so big, and kind of look and see how big it is. And then if you were to go later on at night when it's up high and it doesn't look as big, and do the same thing with your thumb, you'll notice that it's exactly the same size, but it doesn't look that way. This is the famous moon illusion. And what's going on here is when the moon is high in the sky, there's nothing around it. It's just space. You know, there might be a planet or a star or two, but it's just the big dark blue black sky of night. So it makes the moon look tiny. Whereas when it's rising, when it's right on the horizon or setting right on the horizon at a full moon, you've got like trees or buildings and the hillsides. You've got objects to compare it to. So your mind goes through this thing where it sees these comparing objects and it makes it look bigger to you because it's not just surrounded by empty space. It's called the moon illusion and it's a real thing.
And it's basically just a matter of perspective then, basically, is what you're saying.
It's just, it's perception. It's a matter of perception. It's literally a matter of what you're perceiving. It's not really bigger.
Well, I'll have to do that trick with my thumb the next full moon.
Try covering the moon with your thumb, see how big it is, and then do it, go out a few hours later, do it again, you'll see it's the same size.
All right, well, thanks for explaining that, Dave.
Sure. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. You can share this program or check out past episodes and subscribe to our podcast at mynspr.org, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of a dog named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.